On behalf of the Migration Policy Institute's National Center for Immigrant Integration Policy, let me welcome you for coming this afternoon to our fifth annual E Pluribus Unum Prizes Award Ceremony. My name is Michael Fix, and I am the Senior Vice President of the Migration Policy Institute, and with Margie McHugh, I co-direct our National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. As so many of you know, this awards program, which has been so generously supported by the J.M. Kaplan Fund, and by its visionary senior immigration program officer, Suzette Brooks Masters, was intended to showcase exemplary immigrant integration programs and practices nationwide. In a particularly bold stroke at the start of the program, we decided to open the competition, not just to nonprofits, but to government agencies, to individuals, and to corporations. And when the Kaplan Fund and MPI began this brave venture together, we really had no idea what to expect. Would we get 50 applicants? Would we get 100 applicants? When we put out our first call for applications, we got over 500 applications. And over the five-year span of this project, we've received and even read almost 2,000 applications. From those hundreds of often superb applications, we've selected 24 winners, and four of the very best are before you this afternoon. The result of the program, I think, of the E Pluribus Unum Prizes program has been that we've mapped, I think, a previously unknown territory, even an unknown continent, whose dimensions no one, certainly not us, fully appreciated. And I think it's safe to say that we've highlighted and spurred a host of good, innovative practices from community development to secondary education, to credentialing of immigrant professionals. We've helped take a largely inchoate field that often doesn't even see itself as a field and make it more self-conscious and more coherent. And along the way, we've pointed to the continuing need, I think, for a more coordinated and express national immigrant integration policy, policies to our minds include a White House office on immigrant integration and the creation of an immigrant success fund, proposals that may be taken up in the panel that Margie will lead that follows right after this. As we pause this program after 5 years, it was originally intended to just go for three, obviously much remains to be done. Most importantly, the legislative reform of our immigration system, reform to which so many of you, both inside and outside this room, are so deeply committed, and which so many of you have struggled and are continuing to struggle to achieve. And I'm sure that everyone, or most everyone, heard, saw, or witnessed the incredible event yesterday when Eliseo Medina, when DJ Yoon of NACASEC, when Christian Avila of Mi Familia Vota, and when Sojourners Lisa Sharon Harper passed the fast on to others to keep the fight for immigration reform going. As reform and the momentum for reform hopefully revives, let me take this opportunity to thank the Kaplan Funds and their trustees, Peter, Brad, and Teddy Davidson, to thank Suzette, to thank its former executive director, Con Nugent, to thank the MPI staff, and in particular, to thank our stalwart advisory boards, who generously spent their nights and their weekends reading, grading, and advocating, sometimes surprisingly emotionally, on behalf of so many great applicants. And on that advisory board, we include among the advisory board members who intend to be here today, I see Jim Ziegler. We may see Charles Kamisaki, Audrey Singer, and Delia Pompa. Let me say a word about the day here. Will be followed here by a panel discussion that will include our award winners as well as Ron Marlowe, Massachusetts Assistant Secretary for Access and Opportunity in Governor Deval Patrick's administration, and our good friend Felicia Escobar, Senior Policy Director for Immigration within the White House Domestic Policy Council. We'll then hear, I am particularly pleased to say, from Congressman and best-selling author Luis Gutierrez. And then we'll then proceed to the award ceremony, in which I'm also delighted to say U.S. Senator Amy Klobuchar will participate. We'll then proceed to the reception and have what each of us and have a well-earned drink. Before I bring Margie and the panel up, though, I'd like to announce the 2013 winners of the EPUB Awards. And so if we could have a short round of applause. In alphabetical order, the first winner is the Carlos Rosario International Public Charter School, the nation's first adult-focused charter school and a national leader in work-focused English and skills training, represented by Sonia Gutierrez, its charismatic founder and president. Our second winner is Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition and its cutting-edge integration institute that so powerfully brings research, advocacy, and policy together, represented by its eloquent executive director, Eva Maloney. Our third winner is Minnesota's Neighborhood Development Corporation that has been at the leading edge in both community development and immigrant integration, represented by Mihailo Timali, its funder and CEO. And our final awardee, the winner of this year's Corporate Leadership Award, is Kaiser Permanente for its innovative efforts to promote linguistic and cultural competence across one of the largest health plans in the United States. It's represented by Dr. Ronald L. Copeland, the Senior Vice President of National Diversity Strategy and Policy, and by Gail Tang, its Senior Director for National Diversity and Inclusion. So thank you, and with that, we'll turn to the panel.
Great. Thank you, Michael. I'm Margie McHugh, co-director of NPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy. I want to welcome you all, add my welcome to Michael's welcome, and say also Sonia Gutierrez is actually just arriving from Carlos Rosario International Public School. And Allison Kokoros, the Chief Academic Officer for Carlos Rosario, will be representing the initiative on the panel. So welcome to all of our panelists. And I just want to say to all of you, we had a chance to welcome you to Washington last night, but just want to say how good it feels for all of us at NPI to finally have you here in the flesh, because it is a year-long process for us with announcing the awards and going through the selection process. And Michael was right about everyone reading the applications evenings and weekends. I should also say over holidays very often. So we're especially grateful to all the folks on our advisory board. But it is really wonderful to have you here. And I have to say that every year, it's sort of like a competition with the advisory board and all of us involved in the program saying, oh no, this was the hardest year ever. And even though I think that really was what we were saying this year, this past year as well, that I think you should all feel terrific that there was no question by the time we made it to the final round that everyone felt we had truly come up with a remarkable set of awardees this year to represent the breadth of the immigrant integration field. So we think you're a phenomenal group for the idea that we've always had about how do we wrap our arms around all of the, some of the terrific work, but also the many subfields within immigrant integration. So it's wonderful to have you here, and we want to, for those of you who maybe haven't been with us in prior years, even though it makes for sort of a long event, we know that in DC circles, there's really an interest in what's happening both out in the field and in policy questions. And so we really always like to have a policy panel as part, sort of a panel discussion, not just an award ceremony. But then, of course, we also want to have a true award ceremony and some fun involved in this. And so, so as Michael was laying out, you know, this whole event will have a few parts to it. But we think each of them will be incredibly interesting for you. So one of the things I was thinking in terms of starting off the panel discussion was that a lot of, really all of the four awardees are organizations that have been at this work for 20 plus years. We didn't mean to do it that way, but you've all been in it for a long time. And we think that that has some really interesting lessons and implications embedded in it. And so I wanted to start with that idea with a few of you. And Allison, I was thinking that I would go to you first, that you're in this field where we've had a lot of awardees, a lot of applications every year of people who are in the adult literacy and workforce arena. Some, they were elements of some of our prior programs. But there really was sort of a hunt every year in the application process thinking, how do we really raise up some of the most effective practice here in adult literacy and workforce training? I know Carlos Rosario does more than that, but that's really at the heart of it and at the heart of the work that you do. And so since you and Sonia have been there for such a long time, we really think of you as an organization that has been learning in real time and that you're really at the leading edge of what's happening in the adult literacy and workforce field. So I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about what are some of the lessons you learned being in that field that you then put into practice, that really makes you so much more successful than other programs in what you're doing to promote that combination of education and workforce skills for immigrants and refugees.
Absolutely. Thank you, Margie. And I just wanted to say hello to everybody. And for those of you who are visiting DC, welcome to our hometown. And feel free to come and visit our school, Carlos Rosario. We're just located in Northwest DC in two campuses in Columbia Heights and a new campus in Northeast DC by the Rhode Island Metro Station. And we just opened up that new campus, and it is named for our founder and president, Sonia Gutierrez, the Sonia Gutierrez Campus. And we just learned today that the street in front of that campus will also be named Sonia Gutierrez Campus Way in honor of Sonia's legacy and all that she's done and vision. So I invite you all to come visit both of those campuses. But to your point about experience, you know, we really have learned over these 43 years. The school was founded in 1970, and it has evolved and grown over that time to the point that it was named as a national model by the U.S. Department of Education. Why? Because of that comprehensive model that we have. We don't just provide English language or workforce skills in a vacuum, but we provide comprehensive student services for our students that are linguistically appropriate and culturally appropriate, because our adult students are so diverse. They come from over 70 different countries and speak over 40 different languages. And so we have bilingual counselors who work with them one-on-one, and they have a mandate to make sure that our students persist in our program and that any potential barrier that could get in the way will be eradicated, whether it be childcare, whether it be trying to find a home, whether it be trying to find a job. That department goes all out. That's a mandate, and that's something that we've learned over time is crucial to have. Otherwise, it just doesn't work, and your adult learners who are working two and three jobs simply aren't able to persist in the program. Something else, and we've learned so much, but just some highlights. Something else that we've learned is Our students are coming to learn English. That's a driving motivation. It is essential to contextualize that learning. So, yes, our students are learning listening, speaking, reading, writing, English grammar, yes. But they are learning so much more than that. At the same time that they are learning English, they are gaining technology skills. They are creating email accounts, and their English teachers are having them email back and forth the assignments. They are, and we assess them as well on their technology skills at the end of every semester. So we hold ourselves accountable. Not just are they learning English, but are they learning these technology skills? In fact, I was visiting a class just recently, and a group of students were choosing as a project to develop an app while they are learning English in English class. So you see, the class is contextualized, and at the same time, they're learning technology as well as job skills, how to interview, how to fill out a job application, how to shake hands on the interview, et cetera, et cetera. All of this that is so essential, they're getting at the same time as learning English. And then also, we have content English classes that we have developed fairly recently where our students are learning English at the same time as, for example, learning about health and learning the vocabulary in healthcare and learning more about the healthcare field so that they are then sure whether or not they're interested in entering into our career training program in health, our nurse aid training program. And when they determine that, they are that much more ready. And so we have students in ESL health who by the end of a semester not only have learned English, but also have gained CPR certification and have determined if this is a pathway for them in their lives for a career or not. So there's so much more, but I think those are two highlights of what we've found to be really crucial.
I think it was three. and they're all essential, so that's fantastic. All right, so now a sort of conceptual shift and geographic shift out to the Twin Cities in Minneapolis, St. Paul. I'd like to turn it over to Mihailo to talk a little bit about NDC's, the progression over the years. One of the things that we thought has been so interesting. We've gotten a number of applications from folks working in the Minnesota area. There's obviously been a few sort of waves of immigration. It's not an area of the country that is always sort of visible, I think, in the federal policy kind of arena around immigration, and yet it's a fascinating state because of all the diversity that's there and all the great practice that's been being developed. NDC has been at the leading edge of that, but you really have evolved and changed, it seems, your services over time to really be working with a lot of different immigrant and refugee groups that are coming into the city. So sort of similar question, but applying it to your work, you know, what are some of the ways that you've seen the organization evolve, what it's doing in order to meet the needs of newer populations?
So thank you so much for having us here. And our organization really came out of the community development arena, the community development corporation type movement of the 80s and 70s and 80s. So we were very much part of neighborhood revitalization, community-based nonprofits that would try to revitalize a commercial district or deal with a crime or housing issues or whatever. And I worked in that field in one particular neighborhood of St. Paul for a number of years, and then started a bank-based community development corporation. I was going to try to work across a whole number of neighborhoods across both Minneapolis and St. Paul. What we found out in doing that is that there's very little success we were having trying to bring in businesses from elsewhere to start a business on a commercial corridor in one of these neighborhoods for quite a variety of reasons. But roughly at the same time in the 1990, we saw a study that was done in one of these neighborhoods that identified up to, in that particular neighborhood, over 1,000 folks that lived in that neighborhood who were already doing business out of their back door. They were in the underground economy, fixing cars, baking cakes, doing hair, whatever it may be. And light bulb went off, I guess you'd say, from a neighborhood development perspective. So we began working with the community. We integrated some models from international microfinance and village banking and so on, sort of worked it over a couple years into a unique model where we started offering entrepreneur training classes out in these neighborhoods through the auspices of a community partner organization. So they had the networks, they had the trust and the credibility in these neighbors. And these are primarily African-American, white, and some Native communities. Well, at that same time, obviously, we were getting a huge influx of immigrants from Somalia, Mexico, and Laos, and Ethiopia, arriving in these same neighborhoods, but they weren't connecting with these, I guess you'd say, more traditional neighborhood-based organizations. So pretty quickly, after we'd been up and running for just a couple of years, we realized we better start offering classes through these ethnic-based organizations as well in these different languages. So we started offering our entrepreneur training classes out in the community in five languages, including Spanish and Oromo, Hmong, and Somali, plus English. This has led to a absolute tidal wave of immigrant entrepreneurship throughout the Twin Cities. I'd say it participated. I shouldn't say it led to that, but we were certainly a big part of that, and continues to this day. We've now trained over 4,200 people in small groups of 10 or 12 out in their own ethnic or neighborhood, ethnic community or neighborhood, in their own language. Following the training class, then what we provide is financing, and pretty much nobody that we work with can obtain a loan from a traditional source. We work only with low to very low income folks. So we're a micro lender. We use SBA micro loan funds from Washington, D.C. We're a CDFI through the U.S. Treasury Department and so on. But we've combined these sort of business development techniques with a starting and fundamental principle of respecting the skills and talents of everybody who lives in these neighborhoods, whether they've been there for three generations or for 3 years. And from that base, we have created an entire generation of new entrepreneurs. And that brings with it, by the way, other social impacts. These folks almost automatically become leaders in their community. They're looked up to. They're seen as having all sorts of outstanding qualities for leadership, for finance, for basically being successful in an American way, you might say. So as a powerful catalyst for immigrant integration, we think, and that's a term I've just learned through this award, thank you, but we think that the immigrant entrepreneur is a outstanding participant in this broader movement, and we're thrilled to be part of that.
I'll be following up on that with you because it is one of the things we've been thinking about with the awards, you know, about the fact that it's kind of a reach to sort of pull folks who are doing the sort of work that you're doing into the larger vision. But first, let me go to Ava. So, Ava, you're the executive director of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition. You're the represent not just Massachusetts anymore, but also work in a number of New England states. Deep roots in immigration policy advocacy, and also a wide range of sort of community leadership development activities. One of the things we love about Ava's ambition and the organization's ambition is that when they did a process in the state and turned in a report of recommendations for immigrant integration, rather than sort of scope it down and try and put a nice sort of veneer on it, they just put it forward with 131 recommendations. You want to know? Here it is, 131 things that we think need doing. One of the things that that we were so impressed with was this launch of the Immigrant Integration Institute, and are just would like to have you talk a little bit about why an institute? You know, you do other kinds of work. Why did you feel you needed the institute, and what does it help you do better? Because one of the interesting aspects of your work is that there are other organizations like yours around the country, and I think this is a question about how should they go about kind of organizing their immigrant integration policy and program work?
Well, thank you, Margie and Michael. It is a pleasure to be part of this panel, so thank you so much for the opportunity. And I also want to say good evening to each and every one of you, and thank you for your presence and your attention to immigrant integration. I'm foreign-born, and integration is something that I'm very passionate about, so thank you so much for that. And as Margie pointed it out, Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition was formed in 1987, right after the passage of Immigration Reform Act under Reagan's administration, when groups like ours were formed in different parts of the United States to become the voice of the new legalized immigrants and serve as a voice for justice for them. And so MIRA was formed in Boston by a few individuals and organizations to, you know, push policies to help with the legalization of the group that was legalized. And then we grew from a small policy shop into a statewide organization looking into all the segments and all the population that makes up our Commonwealth. The state of Massachusetts, it's home to 1 million foreign-born, over 50% of them naturalized and went through the process of naturalization, and 300,000 eligible to pursue citizenship, and then a segment of the population in a limbo status. And we're very fortunate to live in a progressive state and a welcoming state. So when Governor Patrick was running for office, we approached him as part of the question of, you know, immigrant integration and the question of the foreign-born in our Commonwealth, and made the case that this should be looked at in a broader way, not just, you know, one program over the other, but how can we come up with a policy or with a statewide plan to better include and integrate the foreign-born as part of the fabric. And, it was due to our strong advocacy and the governor's vision to look into the foreign-born assets to the Commonwealth. I'm proud to say that the foreign-born in Massachusetts makes up 18% of the population. So even though we're a small state, we are big in terms of the concentration of the foreign-born. So the governor came up with an executive order in 2008 that covered 12 areas of immigrant integration, from housing to healthcare to workforce development to early childhood, economic prosperity, and more. And in that executive order, MIRA was charged to lead the process, the civic engagement process, as to how can a state plan look like. And as a result of that, the Governor's Advisory Council, which is the legal entity that exists to advise the governor on these issues that I happen to co-chair for a number of years, served under three administrations, finally came into play to look into the picture. And MIRA took the lead to organize the process. Six hearings across the state, giving voice to over 1,000 people to speak to challenges and making recommendations is how would the state plan look like to better incorporate the foreign-born. And we turned the report, 131 recommendations. When we briefed the governor, he said, 131 recommendations. It's going to take a long time to look into these issues. So we felt that, you know, the comprehensive plan was done, but we, as the voice of immigrants and refugees, took it on to look into how we can best help and partner with the administration, with business and other partners to really work together formulating an integration agenda for our state. So in that thinking, and looking at the demographics, looking at the way things were being done in our state and the opportunity with a new Americans agenda, we launched the new Integration Institute as a think tank with projects on the ground. And we can cover the 131 recommendations, but if we can focus on specific areas to make impact, then we can make progress and create a model that would forge policies for better integration. So the areas are naturalization. We're happy that with our members across the state, we help directly thousands of people to naturalize. And as we do the work on the ground, we also do research and look into the barriers of citizenship. The second area is the the professional integration of foreign-born. We're working with the administration, and I want to also thank Ron Marlowe, who the Undersecretary of Administration and Finance for Governor Patrick, who has been really instrumental in getting the administration and other stakeholders to look into licensing policies. And before coming here, I got the letter from the governor who promised to work with us and look into this issue. So we're happy to continue on that. The early childhood education is another one, immigrant entrepreneurship. And so the focus on specific areas to really come up with an integrated policy to make impact for the whole population of Massachusetts. And the way we see integration, it's for the betterment of all. It's not just for the segment and for the foreign-born, but it's for the betterment of the whole society and, you know, creating a strong fabric.
All right, and we'll hear a little bit more from Ron shortly about what it's like to be inside Governor Patrick's administration, because we realize that these sorts of partnerships and bringing together key stakeholders around issues is one of the hallmarks of trying to move forward immigrant integration issues. But first, Gail, I really want to get Kaiser Permanente and you into the mix here. So linguistic and cultural competence in healthcare delivery, it's just such an enormous field, such an important set of issues facing the country, and it is just extraordinary to look at what Kaiser Permanente has achieved over the last, I know it's been a long road or an evolving process, but it is just incredible to see the deep systems that you've developed in order to ensure what I think you call in language delivery, but that there's a whole set of cultural competence skills as well as linguistic access. So we won't have time to get into that, but there's plenty of ways that that all of you can find out more about a lot of the key features of that. But I think one of the really relevant questions for this audience is, can you tell us a little bit more about the discourse or the rationale within the company about leaning so fully into these issues? Was it that it was seen as essential for the quality of care, so it was sort of seen as a no-brainer, unquestioned. Of course, a number of folks in the room here even probably are pursuing it as a legal responsibility. Is it a bottom line issue? You know, I think it's fascinating to see how far you've gone. But what's been driving that inside the organization?
Sure. Well, first of all, thank you, Margie, and also thank you, Mike, and thanks to NPI for recognizing Kaiser Permanente. It's really an honor to be here. Kaiser Permanente has a long history with diversity and inclusion, so it's always been a part of our DNA to really want to do our best and be very inclusive of all the populations that we serve. In terms of what's driving it, you asked the question about whether or not it's quality of care, legal, or is it the business bottom line. It's really all of the above. And I think that, you know, fundamentally, we're very, very concerned about the quality of care. And being an immigrant myself, immigrating here at age 10 with my family, certainly have gone through a lot of challenges, not just with the healthcare system, but also in academia, in anywhere that you go, because this is a foreign place to us. And it was very challenging. And practicing as a nurse, I saw a lot of patients coming in at end-stage cancer, working in women's health in the past. And there's really no reason for that. And the reason why they're not coming in, even though they've already prepaid for their health care, is because they didn't know how to access our system. And once they access our system, and oftentimes when they access our system, it's either asking a child or family member to call in. And oftentimes they're concerned about sharing all the private information. So when the call gets in, we don't always book the right appointments for them also. So there's a bottom line issue. There's a cost issue because now we're not as prepared to take care of the patient because we don't have the right setups. The patient may not be seeing the right provider. We may not have the procedure room set up and so on, and we may send them off and we schedule another appointment. And oftentimes when they come in to any system, not just Kaiser Permanente, and we have progressed a lot more that we can do, is that they're not greeted and met with people who can speak their language or who understand their culture. So even if they speak their language, maybe not well enough, and certainly they don't, they may not understand the culture to provide culturally responsive and culturally appropriate kind of care. So from a quality standpoint, when you don't have that communication, the quality is going to be an issue. With respect to legal regulatory accreditation requirements, certainly there's a lot of that, and it's increasing. But oftentimes people will ask, so Gail, when do we need to comply? And I'll remind folks, the Title VI Civil Rights Act was 1964. But yet, we still have a long ways to go. So it's great to see that NCQA and Joint Commission and other legal regulatory agencies are really taking this issue into account, such as the Affordable Care Act, having many, many provisions within the Affordable Care Act that talks about the importance of linguistic and cultural competency. So from that perspective, absolutely, we need to comply. But we also aspire to go beyond compliance, because we're committed to really providing the best services and the best care. In terms of the bottom line, I talked a little bit about how sometimes mismatch appointments will actually cost more for the organization. There's also the reality of competition in the marketplace. And especially now in the marketplace, there's a lot more competition. So we have certainly experienced that competition in the marketplace, where some of our members may choose to leave us to go elsewhere where they can get the right type of culturally appropriate care and linguistic appropriate services. And in some of our facilities and some of our service areas, actually the minority population can be the majority. There's actually a larger number concentrated in a local facility that we can't ignore. We have to be able to provide care and services to them, not only because it's the right thing to do, but we do have a market incentive as well.
Let me ask you quickly also, one of the things that impressed us so much about KP's work in this area was that that you're actually sharing it with other people. You're an industry leader in sharing some of these practices, making them more transparent. Could you just say a little bit about that?
Sure. We truly believe in community partnership, which is also part of our mission and part of our diversity and inclusion strategy, one of our key pillars. We believe that, you know, in order to have a healthy community, we can't just be internally focused. We really need to see how we can give back to the community, but also to learn from the community. So all the work that we've done, all the different models and programs that we've developed, we share with the communities, and we've learned a lot of the communities from the communities as well.
Mm-hmm. Terrific. So Felicia and Ron, I really want to turn to you, but I want to just ask one more question of a few of you to get a few more issues out on the table, and then Felicia and Ron can respond to all of them. Allison, I was thinking that one of the really unique aspects, one of the things we worry about in the awards program in the field more generally is replication and scalability, that we love being able to raise up, and it's its own good to be raising up really excellent practices, but then there's always the question about how far we have to go in terms of trying to make things more available. So one of the interesting aspects of Carlos Rosario in that respect is that you're a publicly funded charter school. And so I just wondered if you could talk briefly about that and about how you handle these questions about replication in other places, since there's so much interest in your model.
Absolutely. So we, as I had mentioned earlier, the school was founded in 1970 and was a community-based, it was a program, and then became part of the D.C. school system. And then because of D.C.'s major financial crisis, the school was closed at a period of time. And Sonia, our founder, worked out of the basement of her house to reestablish the organization. And then, thankfully, around that time, D.C. charter legislation was passed. And when that legislation was written, the people who were writing it knew about the Carlos Rosario School and how this was a model that was so highly effective. And so effective in training adults, most of whom are immigrants. In fact, they were also considering that one-third of D.C.'s population is functionally illiterate. And so I think that they felt that they had a mandate to include language in the D.C. charter school law to integrate adult education, to allow for an adult education charter school. And so we applied for charter school status, and we were the first adult education charter school in the entire nation, opened our doors as a charter in 1998. And since then, multiple other charter schools have been founded as well, and we have helped them along the way. And it is not for any program. It is for a program that is, I'd say, high performing and that can handle the scrutiny that comes along with being a charter school. Because in exchange for the autonomy of being a publicly funded autonomous charter school, there is this higher level of accountability that as a DC public school, it was much higher accountability than that. And as a traditional nonprofit, a whole different level of accountability than what we experienced in our previous formations as a school. And that's the way it should be. You know, this is public dollars invested in a program giving autonomy. Bring on the audits, enrollment audits, compliance reviews. They come and review every single aspect of our operations, from curriculum to instruction to school climate to finance to governance. And the DC Public Charter School Board, which is known as one of the toughest in the nation, has found our school to be exemplary in every single area. So I'd like to say this can be replicated, and there is a desire from multiple other states. We have had requests from Arizona, from Massachusetts, and from other places, and we are very happy. We are now poised to help open the doors and help other schools and other jurisdictions bring adult ed legislation so that they too can serve adults and adult immigrants in this way, because the model works very well.
Great. And Mihailo, I know that you're working with some other folks on expanding your model. Could you talk briefly about that and how that sort of maps onto key federal policies and funding streams? Sort of, what does it take? What should folks in the audience know about what it takes to expand the sort of work that you're doing?
Well, one sort of powerful starting point is that each entrepreneur is an economic engine in and of themselves. So they are, you know, we don't subsidize them. We don't pay their rent or pay their bills. They are using their own entrepreneurial skills after they've had some training to launch their business, and they're off paying taxes, employing people, paying the rent, etc. So in that sense, it's scalable. Because it's part of the private market, and it depends on individual initiative and skills, and that's what we have in abundance in these neighborhoods. So, you know, now the alumni of our training program currently are putting over $75 million a year back into our regional economy right now, and that's private money revolving within the community, and it's 85% entrepreneurs of color, and it's over 40% entrepreneurs that are recent immigrants. That wasn't exactly what you asked about, but I wanted to say that. Sorry.
Expansion.
To expand, like in Detroit, which is where we're working now. We're not setting up an office there. We were brought in there by some community groups interested in engaging the immigrant population there in ways that could do some level of revitalization in that pretty massive setting. And they had support from Kellogg Foundation. It's actually very cost effective to train folks to write a business plan to get an understanding of what it takes to launch a business as long as you make it accessible to them. So that's really the key. It's not a costly thing. It's a partnership thing. It's a language thing. It's a culturally relevant thing. Because once you teach them, they take it from there. Now, there is a larger piece of money that we use for lending. And that a lot of that comes from the U.S. Treasury Department's Community Development Financial Institution, CDFI program. My staff is back in the Twin Cities right now writing yet another one of these for another round. But we're a CDFI, and that's a huge tool for us. And if that could continue to expand, that would be very useful. We're also an SBA micro lender and an SBA Community Advantage lender. That's another really important tool for us. And finally, the Office of OCS, Office of Community Services within HHS, is a third funding source we use quite a bit for, in particular, for building business incubators, which are real estate projects right in the targeted neighborhoods to house over 120 of these entrepreneurs right now. We use OCS funding for that.
Excellent. Thanks. So Ava, to you, looking from the state level up to the federal level, I know that that you are a co-chair of the National Partnership for New Americans, which is an umbrella of sorts for similar immigrant advocacy coalitions in different states. And could you talk a little bit about what are the key opportunities or hopes that you have in terms of the national work that you've been involved in, thinking about advances we might make in integration policy under immigration reform?
Sure. Thank you. So as MIRA expanded in New England and, you know, we established our presence in New Hampshire and trying to get an integration agenda there as well, also other coalitions across the state that had the longest history as the voice of the foreign-born got together a few years ago and incorporated a new entity called the National Partnership for New Americans, which is the umbrella organization of the 12 prominent coalitions across the country, with the largest concentration of immigrants. And as part of the national agenda, as we're doing our integration work at the state level and some of us focusing more in different areas of immigrant integration, we brought the integration, the enhancement and promotion of integration policies at the federal level using this national vehicle to push for an integrated policy towards immigrant integration. And one of our areas of work is the naturalization campaign. Together we helped 24,000 people across the country achieve their American dream, and in addition to that, we're working with CIS to reduce barriers to citizenship. And I want to give a shout out to our friends at CIS under the wonderful leadership of Director Mayorkas. They have done an amazing job in stabilizing fees and standardizing the fee waivers and customer service, making it easier for us to really perform and make a difference across the board. So naturalization is one area of work, but also we are working to further reduce the barriers to citizenship. So we're hoping for better news in the future. And the other piece of big advocacy agenda is the creation of the new office for new Americans at the highest level of government. And I know Felicia has heard about this over and over again, but it's a big agenda item and a big push across the country that the National Partnership is doing to really create this this entity and codify at the highest level of government to really promote a strategy for immigrant integration. There's a great work being done across the country, and it is time to really formulate and have a strategy that is driven at that level. We strongly believe that investing in immigrant integration, it's investing in the future of our country.
Great, thanks. So Ron, sorry that to you and Felicia, but I know that you've probably been enjoying hearing about the work of the awardees. So, Ron, you're the Assistant Secretary for Access and Opportunity in Governor Patrick's administration, and I imagine you being the target of a lot of outside groups, as well as folks inside the government, where you're in one of these unique cross-cutting roles where you're in sort of in dialogue or in relationship with a lot of different agencies in state government. And I assume that's how AVA has roped you in, and the governor's office roped you into a lot of these initiatives around immigrant integration. So first I wanted to ask you, what was it like inside the administration to have this process for the New Americans Agenda actually happen, result in such a broad-ranging and robust set of recommendations? You know, what is it, what's been your role, I guess, in particular inside of government with trying to react to that? And then, you know, this has been a several-year process for you. Do you want to give us some of your reflections on you know, where you've seen a lot of success and where you felt that it's that it's been difficult to move?
Sure. Well, first of all, let me say thank you for inviting me to participate. For those of you who know AVA, you know that her rope is very strong and it's very long. And if AVA asks you to do something, you almost always will find yourself in the midst of what it was she asked you to do. But in state government, I think our effort, of course, started in the way that most governmental action that is done well starts. It starts from advocacy from outside of state government that has a vision, a conception of what is possible, and that is met by someone inside of state government who has a corresponding vision and is willing to put his pen and authority behind that. And in Massachusetts, of course, that's Governor Patrick, who recognized what I think the one thing that each of the award winners through their work have recognized, that there is an underlying humanity that needs to be reached out, touched, nurtured, reinforced, and supported, because at the end of the day, I think we sometimes lose sight of the fact that we're talking about individuals that share a universal ideal of, I want to do better for myself, my family, and my community. And so it started with that outside advocacy, but more importantly, I will tell you that the reaction inside was pretty much the way AVA described it when the New Americans Agenda hit with 131 recommendations, of which the governor's reaction was, this is wonderful, but we have to figure out how do we prioritize activity. And so he directed those of us on the inside to take those recommendations and to identify a subset of actionable items on which we could focus our attention. That happened. One of the things that I was working on, independent of the effort, but I'm thankful for the New Americans Agenda effort because it helped me get it over the finish line, was our executive branch having language access guidelines. You know, a steady, consistent set of guidelines by which we would guarantee access to state services, not because it's the right thing to do necessarily or it's the moral thing to do, but because we're talking about individuals who are otherwise entitled to services, but for limited English proficiency standing in the way. And depending upon what agency you went to, you may have gotten a very different result. And so the New Americans Agenda helped push, if you will, an independent effort that happened to coalesce with that. AVA's vision around the New Americans Integration Institute, I think, has given some of us within the administration an opportunity to further focus on a subset of issues. AVA was kind enough to invite a half dozen of us to participate on the advisory board of the New Americans Integration Institute, through which we can actually try to figure out how do we push this effort more succinctly, and more importantly, how do we create a momentum that survives Governor Patrick. Governor Patrick is entering his final year of office, and clearly we do not want this effort to die. when he goes away and someone else comes in. So part of this is how do you create and sustain that momentum so whoever is the next governor can't walk away from this effort and instead has to listen to a community that's been organized, has been pushing forward, and will not let these issues go. I will stop on this one point because when I try to, if you give me a mic, I will talk, and I'm trying to be better at this, is this. Because I think there's a lesson that's also learned. And as I look at other states and as they try to push to create a single point of accountability, let me say for those states who do that, you're on the right target. I think the biggest lesson we've learned is that if you allow an effort to have diffuse responsibility, you'll have diffuse accountability. And at the end, you'll have almost haphazard outcomes because there is no one the outside or the inside can turn to say, where are we at? How are we doing? What is the transparency of what we're doing? And so if there is a lesson, and I think, and I'm not going to speak for Ava, if we had to do this all over again, recommendation number one, I think, would have been let's create a single point of accountability that the governor can turn to, that the outside advocates can turn to, and that will issue a scorecard on a consistent basis so that we all know where we are, and I will stop there.
And that's an interesting point to make, you coming from such a well-placed position within the government and also in a cross-cut, you know, where you have this cross-cutting authority. So in a sense, you got the cross-cutting, but you don't have... You're not in charge of enough of the issues. God, we got to talk to the governor about that. You're not in charge of enough of the issues too, right? You need to have that civil rights nexus and some things are closer in than others.
Well, and here's an interesting thing, because I think Gail said it best, 1964 Civil Rights Act. There is a civil rights nexus to immigrant integration issues that we don't always embrace. Sometimes we don't see. Sometimes we don't advocate from that vantage point, and I think we lose opportunities. But more importantly to your question, I think I'm reminded of, I love movies, and someone asked me about Clint Eastwood earlier. Let's go Clint Eastwood in a better time and place when he was Dirty Harry. You know, he has this line where he says, a man has to know his limitations. You learn very quickly in government what your limitations are, and I think the challenge is how do you recognize them quickly and then move to mitigate them. And I think that's a lesson that we've learned sometimes the hard way in state government, mm-hmm. but it's one we're learning.
Mm-hmm. Oh, poor Felicia. So so here you have all of these. Thank you, by the way, Ron. So here it is, this, as you've known, because you've been working on these issues for a number of years now at the Domestic Policy Council, it's a really... a diverse field to wrap one's arms around, and diverse not just by all the different issue areas that they affect people of all different immigration statuses, and then that you've got these different levels of government that are playing different roles. So first, let me give you a chance to say some of the work you've been engaged in, because we know that you've been trying to wrestle with these issues and really bring some of the federal agencies together to do more work around immigrant integration issues. And maybe if you could tie that a little bit to what you see as some of the what might be opportunities under immigration reform. I know we don't need immigration reform necessarily to be doing a lot of the things that need to be done, but certainly that's such an important vehicle, you know, that of course a lot of folks have high hopes for that from an integration perspective also.
So thank you very much, Margie, Michael, Doris, for continuing to host this wonderful event every year. It's always great to see all the wonderful models that you find and you dig up from around the country to really cast the spotlight on. So we appreciate that. There are definitely things that we take back within the federal government, and I know I have a number of federal government partners who are here in the room today. I saw Director Mayorkas walk in. Some of his team is here. Flavia Jimenez from the Department of Ed, and I think I see Ken Toda over there from HHS's Office of Refugee Resettlement. Really, it is there are a number of partners that are working every day on these issues, so it's really great to have them here as well to hear about the wonderful work going on across the country. And then obviously the Kaplan Fund for continuing to support this work so we can have these types of events to highlight good efforts and activities around the country. So we are certainly working together every day on an interagency basis to develop policies and strategies and to promote and highlight the good work going on in the state and local level. I think that there's always more room for developing larger overarching federal strategies. We have general pillars of integration that we've been focused on for the last several years, civic, economic, and linguistic integration that help guide a lot of our work and our activities. But we know that there's more work that can be done to coordinate the strategy. And so I think there's a lot of opportunity in the Senate bill. They create an Office of New Americans. I know folks have talked about the idea of having that office being housed within the White House versus being housed within a particular agency. I think that discussion will continue, as the immigration reform legislation sees its way through the Congress. We know that there's also within the legislation, the reform legislation, more codification of some of the work that's already happening, interagency work and conversations that are happening and a desire for those conversations to happen at the highest levels possible within each department so that when we need to make those moves within a large federal agency, there's real buy-in at the highest leadership levels. We think that that's really important. And obviously, there's some investments in the immigration reform legislation in the integration field to support civic integration and to support naturalization, but also to support the great work that's happening at the state and local level. So we think all of those provisions are wonderful provisions. I was involved in the 06 and 07 legislation, integration back then during the comprehensive immigration reform debates in the Senate was really an afterthought. It wasn't something that people really thought about on the front end of the of drafting legislation. And I think that it's a testament to the field and the wonderful advocacy that they've been doing, that you've all been doing, that it was something that somebody really wanted to take on as a part of the Gang of Eight, the bipartisan group that helped negotiate the Senate bill, as something of their own. I think that will continue, and I know that there's advocacy that folks are doing with the House of Representatives to help educate them on the importance of integration, because oftentimes at the federal level, and I know at the state and local level too, but I live the federal level every day. People look at integration sometimes from a negative lens, that this is about immigrants needing things and taking things from government, when we know that they are doing so much to improve communities all over the country every day, particularly on the economic front. And I think the wonderful work that's being done from the Neighborhood Partnership Center is Development Center is really wonderful, because it shines a spotlight on the fact that immigrants who come here are doers and they're strivers and they want to create and contribute to the economy. And that's the message that as we're developing and trying to continue to push the immigration reform effort and agenda, it's a message that we're always reiterating. You hear the president talk about the fact that the Senate immigration bill would grow the economy by $1.4 trillion in over two decades, would shrink the deficit by almost $1 trillion. There's not a lot of things that we can do on a policy level that'd have bipartisan support that would do that. So it's really important, the work that's happening, and we really think that the immigration reform legislation does offer us an opportunity to codify some of that good work already happening, but we will continue to work to highlight the good work going on at the state and local level so that we can help other communities replicate those models. So, and I'll just highlight a couple things that we've done. We continue to support the Immigrant Integration Grant Program that the Office of Citizenship within USCIS funds, despite the tight budget situation that we face every year. That's an important program, we think, to help shine a spotlight on good models. I know that USCIS's Office of Citizenship is also working with folks throughout the field, as Eva mentioned, to continue to develop materials for the naturalization process and to work with and develop new partners. So there's a lot of work that they're doing at the city level and the local level with libraries that we think is really important. It's a great place and a center, community center, where people feel they can go and feel safe. So we think that that's the kind of work that we need to continue to look for to build those kinds of partnerships at the national level that can turn into local efforts. One other thing I would just highlight, or two other things, if you don't mind. One is the work that that OVE, the Office of Vocational Adult Education, is doing with Imprint, with EVA's National Partnership Organization, and others to provide really wraparound technical assistance to communities who are trying to work in a systematic way to integrate immigrants. So that's something that any of you want to know more about. That I know Flavia is here somewhere, and she can tell you a little bit more about there she is about their right now their call for papers and call for interested parties. And then the third piece I would just highlight is our work with receiving communities, particularly with the Welcoming America organization. A number of our partners across the federal government are really thinking about how immigration and immigrants and trends, and I know you all as well are thinking about this, how those trends impact the community. If there are new folks coming into new communities, new forms of immigrants, new immigrants just generally, it's important to figure out how to bring the community, the receiving community, into the picture as well. So USCIS, the Department of Ed, the Office of Refugee Resettlement are all working in the receiving community space to ensure that we're really integrating immigrants into the communities they're entering.
Great. All right, so I know that I'd have a lot of people in the audience not happy with me if I didn't give you a chance to talk a little bit about the immigration debate. So, of course, the President and your team have been so committed to trying to move immigration reform. I know this year has had its disappointments, but do you want to talk a little bit about what efforts you're making before the session ends and sort of your vision for and hopes for next year?
Sure. So, I mean, this has been a very busy and, I think, exciting year, actually, in terms of how far we've come this early in the congressional session, which is a two-year session, right? The bill that we passed out of the Senate in June is not going to die at the end of this year. We have another 13 months to pass legislation. We all would like that legislation to pass yesterday, as we all know, but we recognize that if we aren't able to get legislation passed in the next, 5 days that Congress intends to be here, we will continue to work on that legislation. So on our part, what that means is, continuing to use the president's bully pulpit. He's been out a lot, both here in D.C. He's had a lot of meetings with key stakeholders. He'll continue to do that. Most recently, he was in San Francisco. And he's talked to faith leaders, business leaders. He was also just this weekend with his wife, with the First Lady, went down to the mall and visited the Fast for Families, the long-term fasters, who just turned over the fast yesterday, their 22-day fast to another group of folks, to highlight the importance, the moral imperative for reform. And so, the economic piece of this, bringing in the faith piece and the moral imperative, those are things that we'll continue to do. We also think that this legislation is good from a law enforcement perspective, and all of those communities we know are traditionally communities that House Republicans respond to. So we're looking to continue to develop the advocacy and the leadership in those communities, which doesn't really take much at this point, but we want to continue to highlight their great work. And I think that, we need to continue to keep up the pressure. And I think that that's something I don't really have to tell many people in this audience to do, because I know you will do it anyway. Our sense is that when we get this done is a function of how much pressure that we put to bear. And one of my colleagues, Julia Rodriguez Chavez, who some of you know, is also very... a phrase that she uses often is, the moment we stop organizing is the moment that we give up and we lose. And so I think from our perspective, we got to keep on going. So the president is very committed, and he will continue to push. So.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you. So It looks like we have another minute or two. So, Allison, I was thinking that I wanted to go back to one of the big scaling questions, which we hear all the time when folks are trying to think about what are some of the opportunities for expanding good practices. This idea of business partners, and you know, how do we, since businesses are such a key constituent in a sense for the current immigration policies, and that all of the work notwithstanding, Mihailo, that of course immigrants running their own businesses, but also that so many businesses are employing immigrants. It seems that that's one of the really significant strengths of Carlos Rosario, is figuring out how to let other people do some of your work for you and invest in what you're doing. Do you want to talk, tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, we'd love to share about that. You know, I think it starts with our board of trustees, and I know we have a couple of board members here with us. Representing Bank of America, we have board members representing construction industry, and they give their heart and soul to this community and so deeply believe in immigrant integration. So we're so fortunate to have them. And then we also have corporate advisory committees for each of the industries that we provide training in. So in culinary arts, in IT certification, and in nurse aid training, we have experts from the Washington region who sit on corporate advisory committees and help us keep our finger on the pulse of their industry. Because we're experts at immigrant integration, we're experts at adult education, but they're the experts in their field. And we have to use them to know, is our curriculum equipping our students with the skills they will need tomorrow? Is our program design equipping the students with the hands-on skills that they need to be effective and to be hired? And so those committees are invaluable to us, and they directly impact our school every day. I'll give you an example. In our new campus, the Sonia Gutierrez campus, our Culinary Arts Corporate Advisory Committee met and said, you know, you're doing an outstanding job of training your culinary students with the back of the house skills. You know, the knife cutting skills and the making the sauces and all that you learn for the back of the house and being outstanding. And all of our culinary arts graduates are hired even before they graduate. So it's been working well for you. But they said, you can do more, and we can tell you what. Our industry is changing. And now people who work in the back of the house increasingly are getting pulled to the front of the house and need to be able to be conversant about the menu, about the wine list. And so that is going to equip your graduates to really climb up that career pathway in our industry. And so what did we do? We designed a bistro in our new campus. Again, I invite you all. so that our culinary arts trainees have the back of the house skills, gain their certifications, but also practice running a restaurant. And we've already begun doing this and inviting people to our bistro, and it is so effective and so important. And we wouldn't have done that if it hadn't been for those corporate advisors who help, as I said, keep our finger on the pulse. They're crucial.
Mm-hmm. So one of the interesting connections between your work and the healthcare industry aspect that that Kaiser Permanente brings to this is that so many employers are also trying to hire the folks you're training in the healthcare field. Yes. Because of the linguistic and cultural skills that they bring with them as an additional skill set.
Right.
And Gail, we haven't had a chance to talk yet, but it's such an interesting part of the work at KP that you talk sometimes about the outward-facing pieces of your work, but also the inward-facing piece where you're hiring so many people with skills, and part of what you wanted to do with the progression of work internally around linguistic and cultural competence was to figure out what those skill sets were and how to understand them and how to reward them. So can you say a little bit about, do you feel like that's made, or is there evidence that for KP that has made you more of an employer of choice? And just how have you built the sort of the building blocks for figuring that out in terms of your staff?
So I think in terms of the internal staff, it's always so important to look at recruiting diverse workforce, right, and bring them in. And oftentimes when we bring them in, we don't necessarily know what kind of skill sets they come with. I think oftentimes we do make an assumption that because I look Chinese or Asian, that I can speak the language. And I've gotten a call from the emergency room before where people are begging me to come and help them because they have somebody that speaks Vietnamese and they need an interpreter. I said, I don't speak Vietnamese today. Or they may call me and say, we need a Korean interpreter. I said, I don't speak Korean today. And then they may say, well, at least you're Asian. And you probably can, you know, get an idea with nonverbal communication. And so this is real. This is real. So yes, we do have a great diverse workforce, and they're truly, truly the engine, our biggest asset. But at the same time, a lot of the programs that we do is to recognize that just because somebody looked diverse, they may not have the necessary skill sets to do the work that we want them to do. So what we do do is that we've developed programs to train them, educate, help them develop different skill sets, and so on. One program that I'll share, and before I share this program, let me just touch on how challenging it is, I think, for any organization to consider the need for interpreting services that are well-trained and qualified. Because historically, and even today, we rely on family members and friends to do it. And oftentimes the providers will say, a family member is much better than any interpreter that you bring because the family member know exactly what I want to hear. Well, there lies the problem, because a family member will add things, they will omit things, and they will polish things. So it's something that actually we're very proud of, because as an organization, we're the first one that put out policy guidance throughout Kaiser Permanente to talk about not using family members and friends and minors. So with that, then where do you get the skill workforce? How do you know? How do you ensure that they have the necessary skills to, let's say, provide interpreting services or translation services? So that's where assessment needs to come in. And that's also where education and training needs to come in. And the program that we develop, one of the program is in partnership with community colleges, developing a healthcare interpreter training program, because we can say from a healthcare employer standpoint that this is what we need, this is what we want, but there's not the supply. We couldn't find anyone that's qualified, that have the training out there. So we went and we partnered with community colleges to develop the supply. So now we have a supply and demand balance. So many of our graduates like yours, even before they graduate, they get taken out. They're offered jobs, not necessarily as interpreters, but as healthcare workers doing any kind of work within a healthcare setting. So in that particular program, we've actually, over a few years, we've produced at least 5 physicians out of that program and a number of nurses, because now they got interested in healthcare or doing other healthcare work. So internally in the organization, we also have to do a lot of inreach to make sure that we have programs available to help our diverse workforce learn the right protocols and have the right skill sets. And with that skill set, then they have an opportunity to learn other things and also get promotions into other fields within the organization.
Excellent. Thank you. I can't understand the signals I'm getting. Is the congressman here? Oh, okay. Let me say in terms of wrapping up that first I want to really thank Ron and Felicia because it is of course for your participation here today, but also just thinking about the roles that you're trying to play in government. One of the things that we are really struck by in this work at MPI is that it takes, first of all, thousands and thousands of organizations doing sophisticated, forward-leaning work in order to make this happen. But then the challenges facing government are pretty extraordinary also, that you're trying to
work horizontally and really think in real time about the challenges that you're facing. And, you know, these are not not always, there's just a lot of institutional change that's involved. What I wanted to reflect back to the awardees on is that we're of course honoring you because of all the fantastic work that you've done, but that the what's hidden, I think, sometimes is the leadership that's involved. You know, it's not just smart services. It is, I think that, you know, there are books and books that are written on this now about how hard it is for human organizations, human systems to be able to think in real time. That we're always sort of looking, what we've built is meant for the problems we were facing before, and that you're trying to then use those systems and adapt them and try and use them for the problems that you're facing now or in the future. And of course, there's a lot of investment already that, that folks have in the way things are, you know, very often or at least a lot of the times for good reason. And it's really not an easy thing, to do that kind of thinking and to be working with your institution, to be achieving that sort of change. So I just wanted to say that, that it's, remarkable, not just in terms of, the really fantastic, and wonderful model programs that you're running, but also what it says about your leadership, that you've been able to really stay current and move your organizations forward. I can't believe, Gail, that we didn't say, you know, I'm sure everybody knows the name Kaiser Permanente, but 9.1 million members, 8 states, you know, like to try and bring a system like that forward, these are really just extraordinary efforts. So, please join me in congratulating the awardees and thanking them for this panel.
For more information about MPI's work on immigrant integration, please visit www.integrationawards.org.